This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The curious incident of The Dog in the Nighttime is the multiple Tony and Olivier-winning, award-winning play that has set up shop at the Belk Theater for a week. It is a curious and unusual event in that it is a touring play, not a musical, but a theatrical phenomenon that has intrigued audiences on both sides of the Atlantic and left many wondering about the lead character's condition. We may get some answers later in the program. First, the rise of activism in the Trump era. From the beginning, well, at least the day after Inauguration Day, there were citizen protests. The women's marches around the country attracted hundreds of thousands of people who wanted to put the new president on notice that they took issue with some of his announced policies. More protests followed in the wake of the travel ban. But in this new activist era, it isn't just individuals who are getting involved, it seems. On Super Bowl Sunday, millions of viewers saw commercials from corporations that seemed to take issue with Donald Trump's policies. Some seemed to show an alternate view of the world, while others were thinly veiled critiques. Shortly afterward, Nordstrom pulled Ivanka Trump's clothing line from their stores, and other stores like Sears and Kmart have followed suit. Some of this is the result of consumers pressuring stores not to carry this merchandise. But do boycotts ever work? And just how much power can corporate America wield in changing attitudes, much less policy? We're going to talk about that with Dr. Aaron Chatterjee, associate professor at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University and Sanford School of Public Policy. He joins us this morning by phone. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You studied the power of activism. So could what we witnessed during the Super Bowl in terms of those commercials be considered activism?
I think so. When you look at the ads that some of the companies were running during the Super Bowl, clearly some of them had political overtones. Although, you know, business leaders, Mike, have been involved in public debates for a long time. So I see this new generation of activists as somewhat of a continuation of what we've seen before. But in the era of social media, it's just coming at us a lot more quickly.
When you say they've been involved in this for a long time, I was really thinking about this yesterday, and I can't remember anybody beyond the current crop of people doing this. So who were they, these people, and what were they vocal about?
Well, going back to even the debate over prohibition in the United States in the early part of the 20th century, corporations and CEOs were active on both sides of that. The civil rights movement, the debates over affirmative action and apartheid in South Africa during the 80s. So, you know, corporations and CEOs as individuals have been involved. But I think, Mike, like a lot of people, myself included, we're seeing sort of a larger number of CEOs involved in getting into the fray. And because of social media, we can track their statements a lot more easily. So I think it is a continuation of some of the earlier eras of activism, but it's just a lot more prominent, and there's so much coming at us all at once.
We'll talk about why as we go through this segment of the program. And I know that one of the areas that you've studied is the expanding social mission of business. And is that what this is, part of their social mission, or is it completely separate from that? And why do they have social missions?
It's a great question, Mike. So traditionally, businesses have been involved through campaign contributions to elected officials, persuading legislators through lobbying, speaking out through trade associations. They've also more recently done things like corporate social responsibility, initiatives that are supposed to benefit the bottom line of the company, but also do good. I think what you're seeing now with Tim Cook from Apple and Howard Schultz from Starbucks and the CEOs of Uber and other companies is that they're speaking out on social and political issues that are not directly related to the bottom line. And that is something new, and I think that's happening a lot more now in the Trump era.
But isn't it dangerous to the bottom line?
You know, this potential for backlash is significant, and that's why I think that we're at the early stages of this and trying to understand from the business perspective when to speak out and how to speak out. Is it a tweet? Is it a press release? Is it doing something internal at the company? We've seen companies ranging from Target to Chick-fil-A experience significant backlash for positions that they've taken. So I think there's certainly that risk, and we're going to see how serious it is going forward.
Nordstrom recently announced that it was pulling or dropping Ivanka Trump's brand of clothing and shoes. Neiman Marcus and Belk here in this area have done something similar. Macy's says it is ending its relationship with Trump brands. Sears and Kmart, which are owned by the same company, have announced that they will discontinue online sales of 31 items from the Trump home collection, including living room, bedroom furniture, lamps, chandeliers, things like that. Nordstrom blamed their decision, or attributed their decision, on declining sales. Is that all this is, declining sales with bad timing so that the optics make it look political, or is this a result of consumer activism and specifically a group called Grab Your Wallet, which formed to put pressure on retailers after the Trump grab them by the you-know-what comment was made public?
Well, Mike, this is an interesting one. I don't have the data to tell you whether or not this is a business decision by Nordstrom coming from the top down, or whether this is a result of consumer pressure. It's something I'm actually looking at in research and hope to have something to say about if I can get access to the right data. I will say this. You know, Nordstrom is characterizing this as a business decision. They're saying, look, for whatever reason, consumer pressure or otherwise, these things aren't selling well, and so they're going to discontinue it or limit the offering. But, of course, because Ivanka Trump is the daughter of the sitting president, this has automatically gotten political. And as you saw with the Trump administration, notably Kellyanne Conway, speaking out about this, it's now put Nordstrom, whether they like it or not, in the political crosshairs. And this is going to happen over and over again to companies in this era. And frankly, you know, they're going to have to develop a playbook for how to deal with this. And so it's a pretty nervous and maybe, you know, uncertain time in corporate America when it comes to activism.
This seems like a significant number of stores, however, who are either dropping all of the Trump line or parts of the Trump line. We're talking about Nordstrom, which is a major national department store, Neiman Marcus, a high-end major national department store, Belk, a regional store, Macy's, Sears, Kmart. This is a lot of stores. So if this is being done because of a legitimate concern over declining sales, is that the result of consumers boycotting these products?
Well, you know, consumer boycotts have had sort of mixed success over time. I know the Grab Your Wallet movement and followed it a little bit, but I don't know specifically whether that movement is attributed for the decline in sales across all those stores. It's something I'd like to find out. It's a good question. I do think, look, consumers are getting more political, and I think that might be what you're getting at an era where we're politically polarized, where our political identity is now coming first and foremost in how we define ourselves. It's going to impact more and more people's purchasing decisions. So whether it did in this case or not, I'm not yet sure as a researcher, but I do think you're going to see companies paying a lot more attention to the political perspectives of their consumers. And that's going to have an impact on what kinds of products they decide to offer.
Because of the president's executive order on refugees and immigrants, 127 firms signed an amicus brief saying that the order violates the immigration laws and the Constitution. They did this in the court proceedings. So why? How unusual is that for businesses to get involved in government business?
Well, the scope and how quickly this all came together was very, very impressive in terms of corporate activity. I mean, you don't often see 127 companies get together that quickly on an issue. And I think the immigration issue is something, though, that is somewhat of settled policy in large parts of corporate America. I mean, if you talk to most CEOs at the companies that signed that amicus brief, I mean, they're in a war for talent. And for them, the idea that we would limit sort of the people who would come to the United States and thus limit the labor pool that they could choose from doesn't make sense. And so I think for corporate America, it's actually been relatively easy to speak out on the immigration issue because it's core to their value proposition, but also their corporate values. And I think that's why it might have come together so quickly. The companies that you've talked about during the Super Bowl, Uber is a good example. I mean, a lot of them rely heavily on immigrant labor as part of their workforce. So for these companies, I think immigration is a natural issue to weigh in on, and the executive order was sort of a flashpoint where a lot of companies got involved all at once.
127 firms signed that amicus brief, but in the scheme of things, 127 companies is a drop in the bucket. I'm not even sure it's that. But within some of the bigger companies that did not sign that brief, there are petitions, I'm told, being circulated that are being signed by employees to encourage their companies to take a stand. How unusual is that for employees to be pushing the upper management of a company to do one thing or the other politically? And do companies normally listen to their employees pushing them to do something politically?
Well, I think it is interesting. We've been reading more media reports of employees at places like IBM and Cisco sort of speaking out internally and trying to pressure their CEOs and their company as a whole to take certain positions vis-a-vis the Trump administration. You know, I think it's a question of how many employees are going to join these efforts. And if a large proportion of employees are encouraging companies to sign on to things like that or become more activist in result of, let's say, this immigration executive order, certainly companies are going to have to listen for the same reasons that we just talked about. If you're in a war for talent and you need to hire the best and brightest people, you can't afford to alienate your own employees. Retention is as important as recruitment. So I think companies are going to have to listen if enough, or companies are going to have to listen if enough employees are becoming activists about this. And you do see this happening more in the workplace. Customers are one angle, as we talked about with Nordstrom. Employees are the other angle, as we're talking about here with the executive order.
Companies have long been known to lobby Congress and give money to candidates for political office, and sometimes they give candidates to candidates on both sides of the aisle mm-hmm. for the same race to hedge their bets. So one of them's going to win. We might as well be on the side of the winner. Now they're making statements, in some cases, through commercials. Is that a way to hedge their bets with the retail side of their business?
Well, I definitely think hedging your bets is something that companies have thought about a lot when it comes to engaging in politics. I mean, after all, for a controversial issue, why would you want to alienate 50% of your potential customers?
Precisely.
I think the rule that kind of governed a lot of this stuff before was what I like to call the Michael Jordan rule, which is well known here in North Carolina. When Michael Jordan, the basketball legend, was asked about weighing in on politics, he demurred and said, Republicans buy shoes too. And I think that the notion of sort of jumping into these debates and having one side mad at you and perhaps, you know, using their wallet to punish you for that is pretty serious. But something seems to be changing in this administration and also even in the run-up to the election last year, where a lot of companies are taking pretty clear stance on issues through commercials, tweets, economic sanctions, the way PayPal and Deutsche Bank did in HB2, where you're seeing companies now more likely to kind of take a clear position rather than hedging their bets. So that's what I find really interesting about what's going on today.
Well, it seems to me to be dangerous because, as you say, particularly in our political climate today, where we're pretty much split 50-50. It's a little over 48-52 maybe. So you're going to alienate a big swath of the population no matter what stance you take. So to do this, these companies must have a pretty good idea of what the outcome is going to be and are probably, am I right in saying that they're probably also being dragged into this by their customers?
I think you're right, Mike, that a lot of CEOs don't seek to be activists. I mean, even Tim Cook, in response to a media question recently, I think he was abroad, he doesn't describe himself as an activist. I mean, these men and women are trying to run successful businesses, and I'm sure most of them would prefer us to be talking about their businesses right now and not their activists. On the other hand, I think they're getting dragged in for the reasons you talked about. You know, in an age of Twitter, the way I like to describe Twitter, it's like a microphone that's always on. And so silence is very conspicuous. And so I think when these issues come down the pike, much like our political leaders are always forced to answer to the latest story of the day, now that's the case for our business leaders too. And there is a lot of risk in terms of alienating core customers. And knowing your customers well, knowing how they're going to react, as you mentioned, has got to be a key part of business strategy because you have to weigh in on these things during real time. It can be very difficult. I don't envy our CEOs at all.
I'm going to come back and talk about two of these commercials that aired in the Super Bowl in particular about their impact, and also ask why now? What's happening in the zeitgeist now that these companies feel that they must do that? We'll do that when we come back after the break with Dr. Anton Chatterjee. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru Gastonia, featuring the new Outback with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. And Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, featuring a steak and wine menu for business meetings, private parties, or dinner. Uptown location open for lunch and dinner, South Park for dinner. More info at Ruth'sChris.com. Well, reports of arrests of people here in this country illegally have raised fear and uncertainty among the local immigrant community. Charlotte is not a sanctuary city, but CMPD has made it a policy not to determine resident status during routine encounters with citizens. So we're going to hear about the local impact of the Trump administration's executive order and get clarification on CMPD's policy from Chief Kerr Putney on this program tomorrow at 9. Stay with us. There's more to come.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, national security and the Trump White House, how the new administration is handling challenges from Russia to North Korea to terrorism. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point follows Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking in this segment with Dr. Aaron Chatterjee, associate professor at the Duke University Fuqua School of Business and Sanford School of Public Policy, about corporate activism in the Trump era. You know, I know you've said earlier in this conversation that this is not necessarily a completely new phenomenon, but it does seem to be ramping up in terms of companies taking political stands and putting, I guess, their bottom line and their customer base at risk. But there have been controversial issues in recent memory under the Bush administration, under the Obama administration. What's going on now? Why now are these companies stepping out and taking sides?
It's a great question, Mike, and something I'm thinking about now. Let me give you my perspective, and I think there's more to be written and thought about here. I think, number one, we're more politically polarized than we've been in a long time. So if you think about the right and the left, there's so little overlap now compared to where we may have been a generation ago. And what that's leading to, I think, is both sides are seeing stories come over social media that upset them, issues that activate them. And they're looking to companies to have opinions on them, because who we buy from is also another really important part of our identity, much like our political identity. So I think bringing these two things together, a contentious and polarized political environment, the fusion of, let's say, our political identity and what we buy, right? So many of us are trying, for example, to buy local because it says something about ourselves and it also contributes to our community. This is a version of that. And that comes together to now put companies on the spot to say, where do you stand? The other thing I'd say is the changes in technology are making this even more acute. So now when we ask companies, we ask them directly. We tweet at the CEO and ask him or her to have a position, and we expect them to tweet back. And that's what's happening during the Super Bowl with Uber's CEO. So I think that the combination of political polarization and the advent of a social media 24/7, always on microphone, is leading us now to businesses being in the frame much more than before. That's, to me, my best guess of why this is happening now.
Well, let's talk about a couple of these commercials that appeared in the Super Bowl this year. The one that a lot of people have been talking about is the Anheuser-Busch commercial for Budweiser, which showed the founder of the company, Adolphus Busch, coming to America as an immigrant, not being welcomed in some parts of the country until he gets to St. Louis, and the president and being told, in fact, to go home, so which is a whole comment on immigration and immigrants. And the president of Anheuser-Busch has said that there was no correlation to the immigrant ban, because they planned this commercial months and months and months ago when President Obama was still in the White House, and they never even considered pulling it as a result of that ban. But now that it's gotten 22 million views on YouTube, the only question he has is, how can we do it again next year? Has there been no negative fallout to this?
Well, I know on Twitter there was some negative comments about the ad. It's always hard to sort of assess, you know, whether those outweigh the positive comments, and certainly 22 million views on YouTube is impressive. I mean, look, the immigrant story that was told in that ad is just a classic American story. So whether or not they thought about it, whether or not it was related to the executive order, I mean, these are ads that could have run in previous years and not necessarily been considered political. There are a few exceptions to that, but the Anheuser-Busch ad, I think, is in that category. So part of it is kind of where our mindset is as a country. Clearly, we were thinking about immigration. When we watched that ad about the founder, it triggered a lot of feelings on both sides about what the ad meant. As the CEO says, though, you know, generating buzz around your brand and getting people to talk about it, that has some benefits. Now, if you're a company, for example, though, facing a boycott or a competition like Target did, for example, when they modified their bathroom policy in the wake of HB2 and other kinds of things, you can also face a lot of consumer backlash to what you're doing, and that can have an impact on the bottom line too. So calculating this is difficult, and companies are going out on limbs here, and we'll see how this unfolds.
And 84 Lumber is one of those companies who advertised in the Super Bowl who kind of went out on a limb. Everybody knows Home Depot. Everybody knows Lowe's. Not everybody knows 84 Lumber, and they set out to make a name for themselves, particularly with younger viewers. Their ad showed a Spanish-speaking mother and child confronting a border wall between this country and Mexico. Fox, the network that carried the Super Bowl, censored the ad. They said you have to pull this or change the ending because they said it was too controversial. So the company changed the ending, and you had to go to a website to see the real commercial. And 111 people did. 111 million people did just that. Is that a case of everything to gain and nothing to lose? Is that why they did this? Or were they really doing this to make a political statement?
I do not know the internal deliberations of that company. I do not, though, think that it can be characterized as nothing to lose. I mean, there were certainly people who disagree with that ad and have backlash towards it. I mean, that company is located, I believe, in a rural part of Pennsylvania, if I'm not mistaken. So it's a little bit different than when you think about Nordstrom, which caters heavily, right, to higher income, perhaps urban consumers that might be the ones who may agree with some of the protesting against Trump. 84 Lumber might be in a different position. So I think it was an ad that was very artistic in a lot of ways, but clearly making a political statement and one that you'll have people on both sides, polarizing, if you will. Now, how many of those consumers are actually going to be activated to patronize 84 Lumber? That's the proof in the pudding question that I want to ask. A lot of people get upset or excited about ads. How many of them actually translate it into buying a product they wouldn't have otherwise? How many stay more loyal to a company that they would have not otherwise? That's the key question that I don't think we have the answers to. And that's something I'll be looking at in my research going forward, but we don't know that yet about those Super Bowl ads.
And also the political impact, the actual impact on what's happening in the country. Here in North Carolina, we've had athletic leagues and conferences commenting on HB2 by pulling games. We've had Broadway show Stephen Schwartz will not allow any of his musicals to be produced in North Carolina until HB2 goes away at any level, amateur, community theater, school, professional. They won't come here. To date, that hasn't had much of an impact on the people who have the power to reverse the law. So it begs the question, if money in the form of campaign contributions is not involved, will politicians and governments listen?
This is a very interesting example. So, our home state of North Carolina is facing, this pitched battle over HB2. If you look at a parallel example in Indiana in 2015, when then Governor Mike Pence signed what was called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, there was a huge corporate backlash to that, led by Tim Cook of Apple, Mark Benioff of Salesforce, Bill Osterlei of Angie's List. And 1 week later, they signed an amended bill. And I think that gave people a lot of optimism that CEO activism could change laws and quickly. HB2 has not unfolded like that, to your point, at least not yet, despite a tremendous amount of corporate activity. I would say the story is yet to be written. There's clearly movement and discussion about that in Raleigh as we speak. And so we'll see what eventually happens with this story. But it's true that CEO activism isn't necessarily going to change legislation quickly. And sometimes its goals may be different. It may be about communicating to employees and customers where you stand as much as it is about changing a law. So HB2 versus the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in Indiana, two parallel case studies that show us the different ways that this can go.
Fortune magazine reports, and you've alluded to this, that a new younger generation of corporate leaders is emerging that are demographically predisposed to social liberalism. And further, a new wave of business education has emphasized the social responsibility of business and thinking beyond simply maximizing shareholder value. This is all business speak to me, but do these two things really go together? Can you protect the bottom line and shareholder value and speak your mind, particularly when it comes to social liberalism?
you know, I live this every day as a business school professor who teaches students who are of that generation, millennials, who are going to go out into the business world and are struggling with these same questions. They have their values, and we tell them not to check their values at the door. They should bring them to the company. But then the question is, well, what happens when you're in a position to speak out and your opinion is not popular or, heaven forbid, political? And this is the kinds of things our students are thinking about as they approach different employers. I think from the company side, they know to attract millennials. They're going to not just appeal to them with salary and other kinds of compensation, but it also has to be a statement of their values and where they stand on issues. And I think you're seeing that confluence with the millennial generation. There are ways to, you know, sort of do good and do well. There's a large amount of research on corporate social responsibility that talks about ways to do this. Getting involved in politics, though, is something different, perhaps. And I think that's what a lot of our students are not yet sure of. And I can't tell them yet that there won't be any backlash or that the backlash won't outweigh the benefits.
Well, the bottom line is
the bottom line. And more than a few of my students, are interested in being vocal advocates, whether or not it impacts the bottom line. So
that's because they're not in charge.
Not yet. Right?
But how long can you stay in charge if you're going to let your social activism trump your bottom line and no pun intended, your bottom line and your shareholder value? How long can that be? If sales diminish, is that going to stop?
You know, great question, Mike. And I think the discipline of sort of the market, specifically for public companies, and you see this, Indra Nooryi, who's the CEO of Pepsi, has done a big push on healthy food, for example. And it's gone in ebbs and or fits and starts, let's say. Stockholders didn't necessarily buy that strategy as well, and they had to recalibrate. And they're still moving that direction, but slightly with a pivot, I guess, compared to what they earlier thought they could do. So using your sort of perspective on the business or a political view and pushing in a direction, you're going to have constraints from investors. For private companies, family-owned businesses, I think the Chick-fil-A one is reminiscent of this. I think there's a different set of rules because if you're the primary owner of the company, you probably have a little more flexibility.
Well, let me ask you about the rule. We only have a couple of seconds left here, and I want to ask about this. Apple has come up in this conversation a couple of times, and it seems to me that Apple as a company and Tim Cook as the CEO can do more things than certain other companies because there's an ethos about the products that they sell. It's more than just an iPhone or an iPad. It is the whole ethos of the company, which kind of ties in to social liberalism and uniting the world and all that sort of thing. So is it easier for an Apple to do this than some other company?
I think it is, Mike. It's congruent with their brand. You know, if Apple was a person, he'd be a hipster in Brooklyn. So we expect Apple to have, right, these positions and have these views. For other companies, Honeymade, graham crackers, for example, it's going to surprise us a little bit if they take a stand one way or the other. So I think for Apple, it's much easier for them to take these stands that are consistent with their brands and their consumer base.
And you can have a positive impact, as we've talked about this, on certain issues at certain times at certain companies. So if CEOs discover that being socially active and vocal works, and I hate to be cynical about this, but will we see departments spring up within companies to see which social issues might resonate most with their customers and therefore maximize sales? And that's the stand the CEO will make.
Mike, you're not cynical. You're prescient. I mean, companies are definitely thinking about which issues activate their consumers. I do think, though, the thing that's going to hold that back is, you know, authenticity. You know, it's very difficult to cherry pick an issue and all of a sudden be passionate and authentic about it. And I think the leadership challenge for CEOs is not just to find that sweet spot for the perfect issue, but start with the issue they really care about. And I think that will be the one, hopefully, that they champion. And honestly, you can't champion every issue. There's limited bandwidth. So hopefully they'll pick one or two and really try to make an influence on those. I do think companies and PR firms and communication shops are thinking about this. I do think authentic leadership will be the counterbalance towards the kind of cynical cherry-picking of ideas.
Well, voters only get to vote once for politicians on Election Day, but they can vote every day at the cash register, so I'd be very afraid if I were a CEO. Dr. Aaron Chatterjee, Associate Professor of Duke University's Fuqua School of Business and Sanford School of Public Policy. Thanks a lot for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Blumenthal Performing Arts Broadway series has been bringing big, splashy musicals to town for years. Rarely do we get to see a non-musical, but long before there was TV, long before radio, long before the movies came along, there was theater, and most of what theater gave audiences were plays, straight plays, no singing, no dancing. But the best of those plays made people laugh, cry, and in many cases talk for days about the drama that unfolded on the stage. Such is the case with The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. That show opened for a week-long run at the Belk Theater last night and tells the story of a brilliant teen who is ill-equipped to deal with everyday life. In a world where musicals get all the attention, this play has been a phenomenon, packing a wallop for audiences on both sides of the Atlantic, winning 7 Olivier Awards in London and 5 Tonys in New York, including Best Play in 2015. We have with us this morning 2 of the lead actors in this production that Time magazine has called the number one show of the year. Adam Langdon plays that young, ill-equipped man, Christopher Boone, but let me assure you, in real life, he is not.
Hi there.
Hi, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Felicity Jones-Latta is Judy, Christopher's mother. Thank you for being with us as well.
My pleasure.
And we're joined by phone by this morning by the producer of The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, Tim Levy, who oversaw the transfer of this show from Britain to the United States. Welcome to our program. Appreciate it.
Great to be here, Mike.
You helped bring another extraordinary British play to America and to Charlotte, War Horse, which I think many people still remember and will probably never forget. It was the story of a determined boy and his horse, and this is the story of an extraordinary boy and a dog. Is that where the similarity ends?
Well, no, it doesn't. What's been amazing for us over the last few years is, as you say, it's really, really rare for plays to tour the United States and be able to do that. And I've worked on these two shows, War Horse and Curious Incident, and what they both have in common is they're fantastic plays, but they are built within a world, within a theatrical world, which is so much larger than that. So they become really more of a theatrical event.
Yeah, this is not your grandfather's play here. This is very hip, very happening, very now in terms of technical and also acting styles and just the way the thing is staged. It's remarkable.
Well, thank you ever so much. I mean, we're incredibly proud of it. It all stems from the idea the creative team had, which was to get inside the head of this extraordinary character of Christopher Boone, who is very, very interested in science and mathematics and space and computers. And they thought, what would interest him in the theater piece and what would he find really boring? And so what they did is they said, let's make this show for him. What would be fascinating for him? So that is why it has that kind of cool, modern sensibility with the video projections, great choreography, extraordinary design. It's about what would be fascinating to this human being.
Well, I got to tell you, Adam Langdon is here. He plays this 15-year-old boy, and you are not 15. You're probably, what, 5 or 6 years older than that?
Something like
that. And it's clear if he's right about this play's about what would be interesting to him and what would bore him, it is clear that what would bore him is a single nanosecond of rest.
probably that, yeah.
It's a workout. It's like a marathon.
Oh, yeah. Well, they say like doing a production of Hamlet is a marathon, so this has got to be a triathlon
for
Hamlet all the
actors. Hamlet just talks, alas, poor
York. Yeah, this is also like Cirque du Soleil.
Yes, it's unbelievable. Yeah. What you have to do physically is unbelievable.
Well, I get a lot of the credit, but there's usually 2 or 3 people holding me in the air when I'm going around things.
And none of you really leaves the stage the whole 2 hours, 2.5 hours.
Well, I don't come on for the first
true.
40 minutes.
Laggard.
So, yes, I have my feet up in my dressing room eating bonbons.
We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about what this show's about, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, when Charlotte talks in just a minute. Charlotte talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Childress Klein Center for Real Estate, presenting the Barings UNC Charlotte Real Estate Capital Market Symposium on March 28th. Details at realestate.uncc.edu/symposium. The resignation of President Trump's National Security Advisor is yet another controversy that has Russia square in the center. And now there is a report from the New York Times that members of the Trump team had repeated contact with Russian intelligence during last year's campaign. A former U.S. ambassador to Russia and others join Tom Ashbrook coming up in 20 minutes to discuss national security challenges facing the barely four-week-old Trump administration. That's On Point, coming up following our continued conversation about a curious incident with the dog in the nighttime. Stay with us.
This is Robert Siegel. On your commute home, you want something different and unexpected. Perhaps even, dare I say it, something surprising. Well, at All Things Considered, we provide those moments. Every afternoon, we seek the bigger picture behind the day's news. We explore and analyze world events and take a break for thoughtful ideas and opinions. All Things Considered, every afternoon from NPR News.
Weekdays from 4 to 6:30, weekends at 5 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Adam Langdon, who plays Christopher, the lead character in The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. Felicity Jones-Latta plays his mother, Judy, and Tim Levy is the producer and also director of NT America, which stands for National Theater, which is, I believe, where this show originated in London. British theater has produced and continues to succeed on a steady diet, Tim, of straight plays as opposed to musicals. I remember going to a weekday matinee, at I think it was the National Theatre in London, of six characters in search of an author, and the place was packed. I don't think that would happen in America. I just don't think. So what is the difference in getting in producing a play and realizing this could make it in America and then getting it ready to come across the Atlantic to America? Because you've done this more than once. What are you looking for?
Well, I think you're looking for something that can have a larger resonance than, say, you know, maybe a smaller drama, which, you know, is fantastic, but it might make it over for 10 weeks. You know, the thing about Curious Incident is we started this show in a 300-seat theater in London and have been consistently amazed and astonished about the reaction audiences have to it. So, you know, from a 300-seat theater into the West End, onto Broadway and now onto the roadway. You know, we play some extraordinarily large houses. Full capacity is amazing. I think it's to do with the connection emotionally with the audience. So when a musical is really working, obviously there's song and dance and all sorts of things, but it's how it makes you feel. And I feel that Curious Incident has that same wallop when it comes to an emotional connection.
Mm. One of the things that I sat there and watched and realized last night is that movies are very good at getting very close up on people and letting you, they don't use a lot of words, and they let you see the inner life of the character in many cases. And that's exactly what this play does. You experience what Christopher experiences in his head. That's brilliant. But how do you rehearse that without the effects that we see as the audience, which are laid in probably the week before opening, and all the special effects with lights and the stage floor and the back wall and the side walls and the sound effects? How do you rehearse it? How do you get it into your head as actors? Go ahead, Judy. Felicity, I'm sorry.
Well, we had the advantage of, and actually Tim could probably speak to this better than we could because the show was already built when we rehearsed it.
Right.
So we had a mock-up of the set in our rehearsal hall, and we had sound. We didn't have the projections, but we did have sound to work with, and the people who were rehearsing us knew exactly what was going to happen, and they were able to, as much as possible, tell us what to expect when we went in. So the tech on the road was very fast and very efficient.
Wow.
I can't speak to the creation of it. I imagine it was pretty wild and woolly getting all of that.
Tim, tell me this didn't happen in 10 minutes, that this took weeks and weeks to figure out.
It did. I mean, it was it was a good couple of years in development, actually, of a National Theatre studio, just in terms of finding the theatrical language in which you could get inside of this boy's head. So yes, it took a long time, but it's a testament really to our creative team, who the way they work, it's this kind of finely tuned engine with Marianne Elliott, our director, at the center of it. Just having everyone kind of rise to the very top of their game, whether it's design, projection, choreography. So they were a really close-knit team making it. So whenever there were issues, for example, moving it from In the Round to Proscenium to the tour version, they could do it quickly because they work so well together.
I have to ask how long it took you to conquer this. To get this into your bones as an actor?
I don't think it's so much about conquering, but yeah, getting it into
your
bones.
It
well, it definitely takes a while, you know. We had a really amazing rehearsal process, so many fantastic people in the room. But, you know, there's still times where I'm on stage and I'm like, whoa. This is a completely new moment, and that's one of the great things. There is, even though there's a very set kind of way of doing things within the play because there's so much choreography, it is always changing.
It's non-musical, and there's choreography, and I believe the choreographers won a Tony for this.
Oh, yeah, and I believe Alex Sharp was nominated for, like, a Fred Astaire Award for Best Dancer on Broadway, which he did not win. To his chagrin.
Well, you do dance on the walls, which I think is something
like that
Fred Astaire's the only other person on the planet who's done that, I think. So, and that was a movie. They turned the room. They don't turn the room here.
No.
You're dancing on the walls.
Yeah. It's a very cool experience.
It's a lot of words.
There are a lot of math,
because your character is a mathematical savant.
He's a genius.
And he is hypersensitive, subject to screaming meltdowns. He cannot tell a lie. Obviously, he has a condition. And they never refer to what that condition is in the play. Many people have speculated.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think it is?
Well, you know, we came into the play knowing that neither in the book nor in the play he was ever diagnosed, and we really stayed with that. He's got this fantastic brain, and he's also his own human being. He's his own individual, and that's something that I really wanted to mine and just be like, right, what makes Christopher tick, and what makes him special in his own individual human being that's unlike every other individual on the planet?
Can I impose on you to do just a short bit from the play? Can you jump into it? Because I think people need to hear the difference between who you are as a human and who you are as an actor. There's a moment when he's on the train and he explains to the audience how they experience the world outside that train window and how he experiences the world outside.
Okay, what are the lines?
I see everything.
I
see everything. Most other people are lazy. They don't notice everything. They don't notice everything. They do what is called glancing, which is the same word as bouncing up against something and carrying on in almost the same direction. And the information in their heads is really simple.
Yeah, and he goes through what they see. Different characters will say, I see a cow, and then you see cows with spots.
But he sees 19 cows, 15 of which are black and white, 4 of which are brown and white.
He's being inundated by visual and audio information. He can't filter it out. So Christopher is ill-equipped because of that mind to deal with the world. And your character, his mother, Felicity, apparently is ill-equipped for motherhood.
She is ill-equipped for motherhood. But you know, going back to the issue of what his condition is, not being diagnosed, these parents don't have help either because they don't know. For him, it's just their son, and their son is challenging. So they don't have anybody helping them to negotiate this and how to deal with the special issues that are raised until he gets this teacher, the teacher Siobhan, who is really his guide throughout the play and his support. So that's another reason that it's interesting not to talk about what specifically right. it is, because it helps to understand how lost these parents are in what they're dealing with.
Because it's a minefield, just negotiating a conversation with him.
Yes.
And you say that you enjoy the meatiness of this character, and although she is semi-dysfunctional, and many people would be in the face of what he's going through, you get her, you say.
I do.
Why? Because you're a mom.
I'm a mom.
Why do you get her?
I think that as a mother myself, it's very easy to feel that you're not doing a good job, even when your family is doing very well. There are those days without grace where everything you do is wrong, and you want to do the best for them. And sometimes you just don't feel like it. Yeah. So I sympathize. Judy clearly loves her son.
Oh, clearly.
Passionately loves her son and really thinks he would be better off without her at some point. Mm-hmm. And I think that what she realizes is that she's better at it than she thought she was.
And because she thinks he would be better off without her, she does in fact go away for a while. And that leaves the two, the father and Adam, together here. It's really interesting to me. There are not many plays that focus on father-son relationships with the tenderness that this play does. Usually there's this wall between fathers and sons, and there's one here too. Mm-hmm. But he is struggling, and there's a moment in the play that's breathtaking where he's asleep, and he doesn't like to be touched. He's asleep, and the father holds him. Mm.
Imagine not being able to touch someone that you love.
Yeah.
Imagine it. And Judy, because she's somewhat immature, she often forgets that she's not supposed to touch him. I built that into it. And she pays for it because she can't rush up and hug him. And
you both come from theatrical families. Your husband, excuse me, is a former professional dancer. Yes. You've been an actress your whole life. Your sister is an actress.
Correct.
In Minneapolis. And your parents both were actors.
Yeah, my dad's an acting teacher. Mom's an actress.
I read that you had no interest in acting, and suddenly you went to Juilliard and here you
are. Not quite like that, but, you know. I got into it when we moved from Brooklyn, New York to Essex Junction, Vermont. Uh-huh. And my previous interests didn't really translate over.
What were your previous interests?
I wanted gang life? I grew up in Prospect Park, man. I went to a private school in Brooklyn Heights. I grew up right by the Prospect Park Zoo, so I really wanted to be involved with animals and stuff like that. And there are no zoos in Vermont because it's too cold. Yeah. So I was like, well, 12-year-old me was like, I'll just take up the family business. Why not? While I find something else to do. And I sort of just kept doing it and doing it and doing it. And when I got into high school, I did the musicals and I studied at New York Film Academy. And I spent a couple summers at RADA in London. And I was like, these are the people I want to spend the rest of my life with. Yeah. And like doing this kind of work is everything.
RADA is the Royal Academy of Dramatic
Art. It is indeed.
The Time magazine review for this play, for the Broadway production of this play, points out that although it's about a disabled teenager, it totally avoids medical explanations or courage in the face of illness sentimentality, and in doing so becomes, they say, a vehicle for demonstrating the power of theater to transport us to exotic places, none more exotic than the inside of the workings of a discombobulated human mind. How did you develop, Tim? How did they develop the technical aspects of this that allow us to go into that mind and really feel and experience what he's experiencing?
Well, I mean, that was the key challenge for Marianne and the team, which is, you know, when you read Mark Haddon's novel, what's glorious about it is it's written from Christopher's perspective. So you get that first-person narrative, and you're inside his head. And so that challenge, as you say, was how to do that in stagecraft. And I think the thing they realized is that actually it's the combination of bold theatrical storytelling and also simplicity. So it is allowing a little, actually, like War Horse, the experience on that. Mm-hmm. You would create... You know, with that, you would have the puppet of the horse and let the audience's imagination fill in the gaps. And likewise with Curious, You know, the entire set by Bunny Christie is this kind of fantastic, kind of Tron-like grid where you absolutely always know what's happening, but you fill in the gaps yourself. So to enter Christopher's mind, you're having to use your own. And one of the biggest joys for me about this show is that I think it does embrace what it means to be and to feel different, which I think we all do in our own ways. And so rather than to look at that from an external position of sympathy or trying to understand, the ability to actually let an audience sit inside someone's head and say, what an extraordinary person, and guess what, they're actually not that different from me, is one of the things I love most about it.
I'm sitting here with Felicity Jones, Latta. And I'm curious about this because everybody who joins the Actors Union, Actors Equity, has to use a name that is unique to them. And you've been in this business for your entire life, and suddenly you have become Felicity Jones Latta because there's a British movie
yes,
star.
Yes, I couldn't sustain a professional career with the name Felicity Jones
longer. Why did she have to change her name? Well,
I don't believe that she's a member of Actors Equity. But
is she in SAG?
Yes, she
is.
Aren't
they reciprocal?
SAG does not have that rule.
Oh.
It's a recommendation, but clearly they didn't make any recommendations to her. It has caused some trouble for me.
You've gotten her fan mail?
I've gotten fan mail. I've gotten her checks.
Yes, and have you cashed them? You should cash them. They're big.
it has been a problem, and so I added my husband's name to my professional name, but my real name is still Felicity Jones.
Okay. And you, Adam, you auditioned twice for this and didn't get in the first time, and I can't believe that. I mean, to watch your performance, it's like, how can this be possible?
Well, there was a lot going on when I first auditioned. I was still in school,
right.
And I was auditioning to replace Sharpie. It was not a good audition.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I remember getting the same kind of working note about five times in one of the sides, and I just could not get it. I couldn't make the connection.
Uh-huh.
I was doing a play at the time. You know, I had
That's
so
right.
much going on.
Yeah.
But I remember when I came back in for the tour, I got the exact same note.
You have said it's hard to take bows for the show. Why?
Because I just want it to be like, I want the audience to like have this moment. But it's hard to be able to be like, right, yeah, we've all been on stage for 2.5 hours now, but where's Christopher to take his bow?
A little note, folks. Once the bows are over, don't leave.
Don't leave.
Don't leave.
Please.
Don't leave. Otherwise, you'll miss a Heisenberg moment where he explains the world in math for about... You beat the clock yesterday.
Always.
I want to thank Felicity Jones-Latta, who plays Judy, Adam Langdon, who plays Christopher, and Tim Leedy, who's the producer of The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, which plays through Sunday at the Belk Theater, blumenfallarts.org for tickets. Great, great show. Thanks for